Welcome to hour two of today's reading of the Arizona Republic for Monday, April 6th. I'm volunteer reader Philip Varellan. Reading remotely, we read from arizonacentral.com. We read the electronic edition of the Arizona Republic. And on Mondays, we start with Sunday's death notices. Peggy Lynn Allary, 83, Phoenix, Arizona. Alfred R. Autry, 94. Douglas Dean Batchelder, 79, Scottsdale, Arizona. Dabney Lee Buckley, 89, Scottsdale, Arizona. Brian Dowling, 89, Scottsdale, Arizona. Bradley Don Gardner, 74, Mesa, Arizona. Melvin Lee Garrett, 77, Peoria, Arizona. Richard Glasgow, 89, Durango, Colorado. Margaret P. Hogan. Leonard Caston, 91, Phoenix, Arizona. Lana Jane Lucero, 82, Scottsdale, Arizona. Carolyn Ruth Gromer Plath, 88, Phoenix, Arizona. Margaret Ellen Poundstone, 92, Phoenix, Arizona. Dr. Raul M. Rodelas, 78, Phoenix, Arizona. Judy Ann Van Dyke, 83, Phoenix, Arizona. Margaret Eileen Waldron from Phoenix, Arizona. Those are the death notices from Sunday, April 5th. Next up, we go to today's business pages, and we go to Harvey McKay's article titled, "Your Workspace Shouldn't Be Your Lazy Place." The business owner carefully observed a new employee for the first 30 days. Not being a real ball of fire, the employee displayed a less than enthusiastic work ethic. Unable to restrain herself any longer, the owner said, "You're one of the laziest people I've ever seen. You have barely completed a week's worth of work since I hired you. Help me understand one reason why I should keep you around." The employee calmly pondered the question and then responded, "One benefit is that when I take a vacation, you won't need to find someone to fill in." In the workplace, dealing with what might be perceived as laziness can often be more complex than it appears. It's important to consider the underlying factors that might contribute to an employee's lack of engagement or productivity. Unfortunately, the road to success is marked with many tempting parking places. The first thing I look at is understanding the root cause. All right, so we're going to start with motivation issues. Sometimes what appears as laziness might be a lack of motivation. It's important to understand what drives individuals and how their roles align with their interests and goals. Motivational guru Zig Ziglar said, "There is no such thing as a lazy person. He is either sick or uninspired." Next, we have skills mismatch. If someone is not performing well, it could be due to a mismatch between their skills and the job requirements. Providing training or adjusting responsibilities might help. Next, we have personal challenges. External factors such as personal issues or health problems can affect someone's performance. It's crucial to approach the situation with empathy and understanding. Before labeling someone as lazy, seek to understand the underlying causes. Empathy and clear communication can turn perceived laziness into productivity. Tony Robbins, author, coach, and motivational speaker, said, "People are not lazy. They simply have impotent goals, that is, goals that do not inspire them." Managers can help by setting clear expectations. Ensure that job roles and expectations are clearly defined. Regular feedback helps employees understand how they can improve and feel more engaged in their work. Take note of specific behaviors or instances where the employees seem disengaged. This will help you provide concrete examples during your discussion. I have had great success scheduling one-on-one meetings with employees over the years. Recognizing and rewarding effort and achievements can boost morale and motivation. Acknowledge and reward progress and improvement. A person may not be as good as you tell them they are, but they'll try harder thereafter. Offering opportunities for professional development, such as additional training or resources, can encourage employees to take initiative and improve their performance. Education is an investment and never an expense. Denzel Washington, the famous Hollywood actor, said, "I'd be more frightened by not using whatever abilities I'd been given. I'd be more frightened by procrastination and laziness." Employees can take several proactive steps to demonstrate their commitment and counter any perceptions of laziness in the workplace. The first one is punctuality. Arriving on time and meeting deadlines consistently shows reliability and dedication. Regularly update your supervisor on your progress and any challenges you face. Effective communication and transparency demonstrate responsibility and initiative. Actively ask for feedback and use it to improve your performance. This shows a willingness to learn and grow. Look for opportunities to go beyond your assigned tasks. Take initiative by volunteering for projects or suggesting improvements that can highlight your proactive attitude. Use tools and techniques to manage your workload efficiently and stay organized. This can help you stay on top of tasks and avoid last-minute rushes. Engage in professional development opportunities to enhance your skills and knowledge, showing your commitment to your role and the organization. You are in school for a lifetime. Maintain a positive and cooperative attitude, even during challenging times. This can foster a productive work environment and demonstrate your dedication. You may be on the right track, but if you just sit there, you may get run over. All right, actions speak louder than words. Consistently demonstrating commitment and initiative is the best way to show you're anything but lazy. An Army sergeant looked disdainfully at the new recruits and shouted, "Men, I have a nice easy job for the laziest rookie here. Will the laziest man step forward?" Instantly, all the men stepped forward, all but one. And then he said, "Why don't you step up to the front with the others?" demanded the sergeant. "Too much trouble," drawled the rookie. All right, here's McKay's moral. Rip Van Winkle is the only man to become famous while he slept. All right, that article from Harvey McKay was titled, "Your Workplace Shouldn't Be Your Lazy Place." All right, next up from our business pages, Ken Colburn's article on technology. This article is titled, "The Truth Behind the Viral Gmail AI Panic." A viral story from last year has been making the rounds again, claiming that Gmail automatically opted all users into a program that lets Google train its AI on your private emails and attachments. If you missed the panic, consider yourself lucky, because the scariest version of this story isn't accurate. But there's enough truth buried underneath to make it worth your attention. Here's what actually happened. In November 2025, a well-respected cybersecurity firm published a report suggesting Gmail's smart features settings were being used to train Google's AI models, and that users had been silently enrolled. The story spread like wildfire. Within days, Google pushed back hard, calling the reports misleading and stating clearly that Gmail content is not used to train its Gemini AI model and that no settings had been changed. The cybersecurity firm that started the storm issued a correction, acknowledging that they had contributed to a perfect storm of misunderstanding caused by Google changing the wording and placement of existing settings not the settings themselves. Snopes investigated and reached the same conclusion. Gmail has always read your emails. So what is true is that Gmail does read your emails and has for years. Think of it like hiring a tax accountant. If you want them to do your taxes, they have to see your most personal financial details. That's not surveillance. That's the service working. Gmail scans your messages to power spam filtering, spell check, smart replies, and inbox sorting. These are many helpful features that we've counted on for years. The question isn't whether Google reads your emails, it's whether you're comfortable with how that data is being used and whether your current settings reflect your actual preferences. All right, the settings to check. The last part is where this story still has legs. The controls are genuinely confusing, buried in two separate locations. And some users found themselves re-enrolled in features they had previously turned off. That's worth fixing regardless of the AI training debate. On desktop, open Gmail and click the gear icon. Go to the General tab and look for Smart Features. Uncheck it if you prefer to opt out. Then click Manage Workspace Smart Features. In that same section, and toggle those off as well on mobile, go to Settings, tap Data Privacy, and make the same two changes there. Keep in mind, all of those helpful smart features will no longer work. All right, take 5 minutes for a full privacy checkup. While you're at it, run Google's free privacy checkup tool. Go to myaccount.google.com and click Privacy Checkup. It walks you through what activity Google is storing, what you're sharing across services, and how your ads are being personalized. Most people have never visited this page, despite using Google products every day. The real lesson here isn't that Google is secretly training AI on your personal messages. It's that most of us accepted default settings years ago and never looked back. That's a habit worth breaking. All right, Ken Colburn's article was titled "The Truth Behind the Viral Gmail AI Panic." Our final article from the business pages is titled "Japan Invests Up to $40 billion in U.S. Nuclear Reactors." This is by Mariah Franklin from the Knoxville News Sentinel and the USA Today Network. Japanese leaders are investing up to $40 billion in small nuclear reactors in Tennessee and Alabama through a 2025 deal reached with the Trump administration. The deal is part of a trade agreement that commits Japan to a $550 billion total of investment in the United States. Japan also will invest in natural gas generation, a key energy interest of Trump's. Japanese Prime Minister Sune Takaichi announced the agreements during her visit to the United States in March. GE Hitachi, which is partnering with the Tennessee Valley Authority on the Clinch River Small Modular Reactor Project in East Tennessee, is listed as the project operator in fact sheets about the investments on the White House and Commerce Department websites. The groundbreaking commercial deployment of the advanced SMRs in the U.S. will serve as a next-generation stable power source, stabilizing electricity prices for the American people and strengthening the U.S. leadership in global technological competition, Commerce Department officials said in a fact sheet. TVA estimated the cost of a 300-megawatt small modular reactor at $5.4 billion, according to the utility's 2025 draft integrated resource plan. Small modular nuclear reactors are a fraction of the size of giant plants that require huge cooling towers. TVA serves almost all of Tennessee, but only the northern part of Alabama, which hosts the utility's oldest and most powerful nuclear plant, Browns Ferry in Limestone County. The plant produces about a fifth of the utility's total generating capacity. TVA also owns an unfinished nuclear plant in Hollywood, Alabama, near Huntsville. The $40 billion investment represents a broader sense among Japanese officials that Tennessee's energy business is on the upswing, said U.S. Senator Bill Hagerty, a Republican from Tennessee. Hagerty, a former ambassador to Japan, said on April 2nd that Japan's business community is pleased to return to Tennessee. We can deliver here in an incredible way, he said. Hagerty, who serves on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, said he was deeply involved in the trade deal. The investment is something I've been trying to nurture for a long time, since before I was ambassador, Hagerty told Knox News. The Japanese see the strategic value beyond just the economic impact. There's a national security component to their desire to invest in America. That value is tied to Japanese and American competition with China, he said. Since taking office as a senator, Hagerty has been a proponent of speeding up nuclear development, especially in Tennessee. At times, he's criticized TVA's leaders as moving too slowly. In a 2025 op-ed piece in Power magazine, Hagerty said Senator Marsha Blackburn, a Republican from Tennessee, both close allies of President Trump, called for a new board to direct TVA and an interim CEO from outside the utility to lead daily operations, citing, among other things, the pace of nuclear progress. Shortly after the piece was published, Don Mowell, who had been TVA's chief operating officer, was appointed the utility's next CEO, and Trump fired several board members, leaving TVA without a quorum for months. Okay, that article from today's paper was titled Japan Invests Up to $40 billion in U.S. Nuclear Reactors, and that was by Mariah Franklin. All right, we move on to sports, and from the front pages of today's sports, an article from the NBA titled Stoudemire, D'Antoni Enter Hall of Fame. This is by Michelle Gardner from the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. There was a uniquely Phoenix flair to the Naismith Hall of Fame festivities held in conjunction with the NCAA's Final Four at Lucas Oil Stadium. This year's inductees met with the media on April 4th, ahead of the first of the two men's semifinal games. Among those honored were longtime coach Mike D'Antoni, as well as one of the stars of his teams, Amari Stoudemire. Stoudemire, now 43, was a six-time NBA All-Star and a 2003 NBA Rookie of the Year. He averaged 21.4 points, 8.3 rebounds during his first 8 seasons with the Phoenix Suns before signing with the New York Knicks. D'Antoni, now 74, coached the Suns from 2003 to 2008 and was known for his up-tempo, entertaining brand of offense. D'Antoni's impact spans continents, having coached professionally in Italy for 8 seasons before bringing his ideas to the NBA, where he amassed nearly 1,200 career wins. He was named NBA Coach of the Year twice in 2005 and 2017, served as an assistant coach for the gold medal winning team in 2012, and was recognized as one of the 50 greatest contributors in EuroLeague history in 2008. The two thought it appropriate that they were included in the same class. One of the bigger reasons I'm here is because of the man down there, D'Antoni said, looking to his left when Stoudemire sat 4 spots away. So it's really special to be able to come in here with Amari. He and Steve Nash and Sean Marion and different guys on the team, we had a vision that the Colangelos and myself wanted a way to play, and then they carried it out. Stoudemire agreed. Going into the Hall of Fame with Coach D'Antoni, the way he changed the game, not only for us but for the NBA, and allowing us to really be able to play our full game and reach our full potential. Stoudemire was the 9th overall pick in the 2002 NBA draft directly out of high school. As basketball players, he continued, you always dream of being versatile and being able to express your game in a versatile way. To play that way for those years in Phoenix because of Mike D'Antoni's innovative mindset for that type of play allowed us to be very successful. Without that success, I wouldn't be here today. So to go into the Hall of Fame with Coach D'Antoni is pretty cool. The rest of the class includes referee Joey Crawford, longtime Gonzaga coach Mark Few, Doc Rivers, Elena Del Don, Shamik Holdsclaw, and Candace Parker. The 1996 United States women's national team is going in as a group. Del Don was the lone inductee not on hand here at the press conference. The formal induction will take place on Saturday, September 6th in Springfield, Massachusetts. All the inductees called the experience a dream come true, said it's not necessarily a goal they thought about early on. They were just playing the game they loved. To be part of the Hall of Fame is a dream come true, Stoudemire said. As a kid, you play basketball because you love the sport, and then you begin to try to chase your dreams of becoming the best player you can possibly be. But you don't really imagine being in the Hall of Fame. You just go for what you know and try to figure out how to be the best you can be. D'Antoni and Rivers signaled out players they had the opportunity to coach, while Holdsclaw and Parker emphasized the growth of the women's game. A lot of coaches have already said, without great players, nothing good happens, D'Antoni said. I had some great players. All right, that article from the front pages of Today's Sports was titled Stoudemire, D'Antoni Enter Hall of Fame, and that was by Michelle Gardner from the USA Today and the USA Today Network. Next up from the front pages, an article titled Arizona's Dream Season Concludes in the Final Four. And this one is also by Michelle Gardner. Michigan 91, Arizona 73. And that happened Saturday. All season long, the Arizona Wildcats owned the paint. They made more free throws than their opponents attempted. They were secure with the ball. On the few occasions they trailed, they found a way to figure it out, as head coach Tommy Lloyd often put it. This time, there was no figuring it out. Michigan overpowered Arizona 91-73 on April 4th in front of 72,111 fans at Lucas Oil Stadium in the second NCAA tournament semifinal. The win sends the Wolverines, who are 36-3, into the championship game on April 6th against Connecticut, who are 34-5. A 71-62 winner over Illinois earlier in the night. With 51 seconds left and the Wolverines up by 23, Coach Dusty May called a timeout for the opportunity to pull his starters. Arizona coach Tommy Lloyd did the same. Moments later, Arizona players strolled off the court, expressions of disbelief across their faces. Jaden Bradley and Koa Pete walked through the tunnel arm in arm, Pete with a towel draped over his head. The Wildcats weren't just beaten, they were manhandled, something completely unfamiliar for a team whose only two regular season losses were by a combined 7 points. Lloyd admitted it will probably take a few days to process. I thought we had a chance to win this four-team tournament, Lloyd said. Obviously, Michigan had other thoughts today. We'll get back home and take a breath, but I know, myself, no loss at the end of the season feels great, but I also think that it can be a great learning tool. So we're going to take a breath and probably try to figure out what our roster looks like next year. And like I've always said in this business, as a coach, you've got to be tough enough to take disappointment and show back up. We're going to show back up. We're going to try to do this again, but see if we can do it a little bit better. The Wildcats, 36-3, were making their fifth appearance in the Final Four, the first since 2001 when they made their title tilt. The only championship came way back in 1997. Many national pundits thought this was the year the school could break that long drought. The Wildcats defeated 14 nationally ranked team, the most by a team since rankings started. They were battle-tested, winning both the Big 12 regular season title and the conference tournament. But Michigan came in battle-tested, too. It's one of the few teams that has the size to match up with the Wildcats. That made all the difference. Arizona has a 7'2" behemoth in Mo Crivis, but Michigan countered with 7'3" Adai Mara. Mara, who previously played at UCLA, tallied 26 points, 9 rebounds, and 2 blocks. The Wolverines also started a pair of 6'9 forwards in Merez Johnson and Yaxel Lendenborg, who combined for another 21 points and 10 rebounds. Michigan finished with a 19-12 edge in second chance points. Lendenborg sprained an ankle in the first half. He returned in the second but played just 15 minutes in the game, although it was an impactful 15 minutes. Their size really impacted the game, Lloyd said. I felt that. I see they only have Mara down for 2 blocks, but there's no way I could think of 3 that he tipped. You know what I mean, just right off the top of my head. They're one of those teams, I would say, like Houston's like that, or even Iowa State's like that. Teams we played, you have to play them a few times, and after you get kind of used to playing them a few times, you get more comfortable. I wish we had another crack at it, but we don't. And so they get a ton of credit. Michigan came in as a 1.5-point favorite, which indicated the game was a toss-up, but it was never close. The Wildcats trailed 48-32 at the half, the largest deficit the team has faced at any point this season. That hill to climb got steeper at 23 points just 5 minutes into the second half and was up to 30 at 77-47 with 10:31 left. There was no coming back from that. Part of the disappointment comes from the fact that next season the team will look a lot different. For many, this was their shot. 3 of the top 7 are graduating, and freshman phenoms Koa Pete and Braden Burries are likely to head to the NBA. Pete won 4 state titles at Perry High School, so ending the season with a loss is something unfamiliar. He says he took pride in being a hometown kid and representing the state. Pete accompanied Lloyd to the post-game interview room along with Burries, Bradley, and Lloyd, but had his head buried in his arm and when others were answering questions. It means everything to me, being a kid from Arizona, putting on this jersey, having Arizona across my chest, he said. Like I said at the beginning of the season, when I put Arizona across my chest, I'm going to go 110% every game and leave no regrets. I'm just really thankful for the brand and the program and for everything they did for me. And these teammates right here, I'm just super blessed. And it was a special year, and I'm just really thankful for everybody in Tucson. Players were asked to reflect on their favorite moments of the season. Each said it wasn't one win. It was more about the time they spent together. I would say just on and off the court, Bradley said. I feel like you really get to figure your teammates out, know what they're like, meet their families, just stuff beyond basketball. I felt like it brings you closer on the court, and I feel like we did a lot of stuff like that this year. Arizona shot just 36.6%, 26 for 71, which included a 6 from 17 from deep. Pete had 16 points, but it took a 6 for 18 showing from the field. Burries and Anthony Del Orso each had 13, but Burries was only 4 for 16 from the field and 2 for 10 from deep. The Wildcats tallied 14 turnovers, which allowed Michigan to finish with a 26-12 advantage in points off turnovers. Michigan shot 47.8%, 33 for 69, including 12 for 27 from deep. I think a lot of it is simply matchups, May said. When we've played this model, this Arizona model this year, and they're the souped-up version, they're the steroid version of Gonzaga and these other teams, we just felt like if a team relies on scoring 15 feet and in with Adai, Merez, and Yaxel, and Namari Burnett, and Roddy Gale, because of our size, length, it's going to be tough to score enough points 15 feet in. And if we're making some shots and we're in a decent rhythm offensively, we matched up well with Arizona, better than we have with some other teams this year. All right, that article from the front pages of today's sports was titled Arizona's Dream Season Concludes in the Final Four, and that was by Michelle Gardner. All right, we're at the midway point of today's reading of the Arizona Republic for Monday, April 6th. I want to remind you, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. And remember, you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. All right, to get started in our last half hour, we go to an article from the paper titled Trump Issues More Threats Against Iran. This is by Catherine Palmer from the USA Today. President Donald Trump took to social media on April 5th to applaud the U.S. military's rescue of the second airman whose fighter jet was shot down over Iran, and to issue an expletive-laden threat against the Middle Eastern nation to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. After extending the deadline on his ultimatum that Iran cease its effective blockade on ships passing through the oil route, the president said the regime now has until April 7th to meet his demands, threatening strikes on critical Iranian infrastructure. Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it, Trump wrote in the April 5th post on Truth Social. Open the expletive strait, you crazy expletive, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. The president signed off his message to the country. Praise be to Allah. The United States and Israel have intensified pressure on Iran to open the Strait of Hormuz, which usually carries about a fifth of global oil and liquefied natural gas, or face attacks on energy facilities. If they don't come through, if they want to keep it closed, they're going to lose every power plant and every other plant they have in the whole country, Trump told the Wall Street Journal on April 5th. But we are in a position that's very strong, and that country will take 20 years to rebuild, if they're lucky, if they have a country, he said. And if they don't do something by Tuesday evening, they won't have any power plants, and they won't have any bridges standing. When asked if he is concerned the people of Iran could suffer if civilian infrastructure is hit, Trump replied, "No, they want us to do it," arguing that Iranian people are living in hell. However, in the kind of mixed messaging that has baffled supporters, foes, and financial markets alike, Trump told Fox News on April 5th that Iran was negotiating with a deal possibly by April 6th. Tehran is demanding an end to hostilities, and Parliamentary Speaker Mohammed Begar Ghalibaf condemned Trump's threat, saying he was being misled by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. "Your reckless moves are dragging the United States into a living hell for every single family, and our whole region is going to burn because you insist on following Netanyahu's commands," he posted on X. Iran has so far shown no signs of complying with Trump's demand to reopen Hormuz, despite the damage to its military and civilian infrastructure by weeks of U.S. and Israeli attacks. All right, airmen seriously wounded. The second service member rescued by U.S. Special Operations Forces, who had spent 2 days inside Iranian territory, is seriously wounded, Trump said on April 5th. On April 3rd, an F-15E fighter went down over Iran, prompting a U.S. rescue mission that quickly recovered one crew member, but another from the fighter aircraft had remained missing. In the Truth Social post early on April 5th, the president described an intense search and rescue operation that led to the crew member being found safe. This brave warrior was behind enemy lines in the treacherous mountains of Iran, being hunted down by our enemies, who were getting closer and closer by the hour, but was never truly alone, Trump said. The second member of the fighter's jet's two-man crew sustained injuries, but he will be just fine, Trump said, describing the crew member as a highly respected colonel. Trump said dozens of U.S. aircraft armed with the most lethal weapons were involved in the mission. He said the U.S. military monitored the location of the missing crew member 24 hours a day as they planned his rescue. The president noted the rescue of another U.S. pilot yesterday, which he said had not been officially confirmed because military officials did not want to jeopardize a second rescue mission. The timing of that rescue was unclear, as were details about the pilot or the aircraft. This is the first time in military memory that two U.S. pilots have been rescued separately deep in enemy territory, Trump said in the Post. The New York Times and CBS News reported that an A-10 Warthog plane that was part of the search and rescue mission was fired on by Iranian forces and the pilot ejected over the Persian Gulf but was rescued. In a post on Truth Social, the president said he will hold a news conference from the Oval Office with the U.S. military at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on April 6th. Iran, U.S. aircraft hit. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps told the Tasnim news agency that several U.S. aircraft were destroyed during the rescue mission. The outlet is closely affiliated with the guards. Iranian officials said a C-130 military transport plane and two Black Hawk helicopters were among the downed craft, according to Reuters. The Pentagon did not confirm or deny the reports when contacted by USA Today for comment, instead referring to the president's initial social media post announcing the second airman's rescue. All right, at least 11 killed in Lebanon. The war, which opened with United States and Israeli airstrikes across Iran on February 28th, has spread into Lebanon, where Israel has resumed its campaign against the Iranian-backed Hezbollah. Thousands have been killed, mainly in Iran and Lebanon. An Israeli airstrike on Kafarda, a village in South Lebanon, killed 7 people on April 5th, Lebanon's health ministry said in a statement. Another Israeli attack on the Nia neighborhood in Beirut killed 4 people and injured 39 others, the ministry added. The strike on Kafarda followed an overnight evacuation order by the Israeli military instructing residents to leave. As Lebanese Christians, who make up roughly a third of the population, marked Easter Sunday, the country experienced one of the most violent days since fighting with Israel erupted early in March. The southern suburbs of the capital were hit by 8 airstrikes, state media reported. Earlier on April 5th, the Lebanese army said a soldier had been killed in an Israeli strike in southern Lebanon. All right, that article from today's paper was titled, Trump Issues More Threats Against Iran, and that was by Catherine Palmer. Next up, our article is titled, Ukraine, Syria Agree to Work Together on Security, and this is from Reuters. Ukraine and Syria pledged greater security cooperation in talks on April 5th, President Volodymyr Zelensky said, as Kiev seeks to promote its military expertise across the region following the outbreak of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Zelensky, continuing his tour of Middle East countries, met with his Syrian counterpart, Ahmed al-Shara, in Damascus. We agreed to work together to provide more security and opportunities for developments for our societies, Zelensky wrote on Telegram. In a later post, Zelensky said there had been wide-ranging discussions with the Syrian leader and three-way talks that included Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan. We managed to discuss everything from security and defense issues and the situation in the region due to all the events around Iran to energy and infrastructure cooperation between our countries, Zelensky wrote. In recent weeks, Zelensky has visited Middle East countries offering Ukrainian expertise in countering drone and missile attacks developed during its 4-year war with Russia. Since the war began on February 28th, Iran and its proxies have launched strikes on U.S. allies and bases in the region. Syria is not known to have any air defenses capable of dealing with Iranian drones or missiles. Zelensky also said Ukraine, a major grain producer, wanted to contribute to Middle East food security and told Syrian leader Kiev was a reliable supplier. The two presidents discussed opportunities to strengthen regional food security, he said. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Andre Sibia, writing on X, described the visit as a milestone. He said his talks with the Syrian and Turkish foreign ministers covered security and maritime trade, among other topics. In Turkey on April 4th, Zelensky said he had agreed to new security steps with Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan and discussed joint gas infrastructure projects and a gas field development. It was the Ukrainian leader's first trip to Syria since diplomatic relations were restored in September following the fall of Syria's longtime leader Bashar Assad in late 2024. Zelensky signed long-term military cooperation deals with Saudi Arabia and Qatar last weekend, and he said a similar agreement was closed with the UAE. Syria is home to two major Russian military bases. Shara has said Syria wants to turn them into army training centers. All right, that article from today's paper was titled Ukraine, Syria Agreed to Work Together on Security, and that was put together by Reuters. Our next article is titled South Africans Challenge Mine Rush in Biodiversity Hotspot. It's by Kim Harrisburg Thompson. South Africa's western coastline is known for its wildflowers, archaeological sites, and pristine beaches. But for mining companies, the real attraction is not what you can see, it's what you can dig up. Large parts of the coastline are already being actively mined or reserved for prospective mining. According to the civil society group Protect the West Coast, that's PTWC, South Africa's west coast is being mined and prospected for heavy minerals, diamonds, and rock phosphate, with 48 new mining applications submitted in 2026 alone. The Department of Mineral and Petroleum Resources said these figures did not align with its own and said that in Western Cape Province, it had received 6 prospecting applications and 2 mining permit applications. It did not give figures for the rest of the West Coast. Local groups, including artists, indigenous leaders, and scientists, have launched campaigns, petitions, and legal action in recent months, citing the potential risks of mining the area. The West Coast is at a tipping point. We risk losing birds, animals, and ecosystems that cannot be restored, said Mike Schlebach, managing PTWC. Heavy minerals such as zircon, rutile, and ilmenite can be used in renewable energy technology such as solar panels and wind turbines. Global demand for these so-called green minerals needed in the energy transition is set to triple by 2030, according to the International Energy Agency. There is this mad dash for rare earth and critical minerals, but there has to be proper oversight so that the poorest communities are not left behind, Schellbach told the Thomas Reuters Foundation. Inland, 1,118 square miles have been earmarked for diamond mining, with up to 1,801 square miles in the Western Cape reserved for prospecting, according to PTWC. Currently, the equivalent of 5,000 football fields of land, roughly 23 square miles, has not been rehabilitated to an environmentally healthy state on the West Coast following decades of mining, a PTWC report said. Open pits, craters, dust, and barren slopes of sand indicate decades of unrehabilitated diamond mines in the region. The DMPR said it could not confirm this figure, and that closure certificates were only issued once mining companies complete rehabilitation following an inspection. Only 10% of the region is currently protected, and the region is home to more than 6,300 endemic plant and animal species, according to PTWC. The department said expert studies and recommendations helped determine whether environmental authorization was granted and under which conditions to mining companies. We need to be careful about what type of development occurs and how that development takes place, said University of Cape Town restoration botanist Peter Carrick. This is a uniquely beautiful landscape, which is also incredibly fragile. Alongside the West Coast biodiversity, the region also holds significant value for indigenous groups with ties to archaeological and heritage sites, as well as small-scale fishers. More than 200 protesters gathered in March to challenge the surge in mining interest in the region, alongside a 16-foot driftwood sculpture of a gannet bird made by local artists to symbolize the fragility of the native bird species in the region. A petition to protect the region from mining has drawn more than 60,000 signatures. Our people have lived here for thousands of years, says Gayab Martinez Fredericks, leader of the indigenous Ama-Nama people. We understand the value of our natural heritage, and we want to safeguard our children's livelihoods as well as our own. Fishermen groups said they had seen a decrease in the fish population. All right, that article from today's paper is titled South Africans Challenge Mine Rush in Biodiversity Hotspot, and that was put together by Kim Harrisburg Thompson. Next up is Clay Thompson's article titled There's No Doubt About These Names Elevations. This is from the best of Clay Thompson from the Arizona Republic, the USA Today Network, from August 15th, 2015. Here's the question. While driving from Heber Overgaard to Payson, I saw a sign as we were coming over a bridge that said Doubtful Canyon. How did the canyon get its name? Doubtful Canyon in Cochise County got its name because it was a doubtful sort of place. The Indians there were so angry about the encroachments of whites that it was considered risky for immigrants to travel through the canyon and pass in the surrounding mountains. Hence, it was doubtful they could make it. The Butterfield Overland Mail Service had a station there for a time. It was called the Doubtful Pass Station, later shortened to Doubtful Canyon. Do you know how Bloody Basin got its name? We pass the sign all the time driving north on Interstate 17 and are curious. There are a couple of myths about Bloody Basin. One holds that during range wars between sheep ranchers and cattlemen, a big flock of sheep was slaughtered there by the cow people. The fact, however, is that in March 1873, U.S. Army soldiers tracked a band of Apaches who had attacked and killed three whites to nearby Turret Peak. The soldiers attacked at dawn and caught the Apaches flat-footed. Between 25 and 57 Indians were killed, with no loss of life to troops. As long as we're at it, you've probably also noticed a sign on I-17 for Big Bug Wash. There are two stories about this. One holds that in 1863, a group of prospectors were attacked by a horde of large insects. Another says Big Bug was slang for a foreman or boss. I was surprised to read that the mean elevation of Arizona is 4,100 feet. Most people view Arizona as desert, but much of it is above 3,000 feet. Just how much of Arizona is above 3,000 feet? New to these parts, ain't you, stranger? You need to get out more. Arizona has a wide range of elevations, climates, and what you call biomes. That's what makes things so interesting. As for elevations, I am not about to list all the spots on Arizona that are 3,000 or more feet above sea level. We'd be here all day, and you probably haven't read the funnies yet. The highest peak in Arizona is Humphreys Peak, part of the San Francisco Peaks north of Flagstaff. It tops out at 12,637 feet. Next are Agassiz Peak, 12,356 feet, and Fremont Peak, 11,946 feet, both also in the San Francisco Peaks. At random, a few more Arizona sites. Kingman is at 3,471 feet. Winslow is at 4,866 feet, and the south rim of the Grand Canyon is around 7,000 feet. And as long as we're at it, Arizona's lowest spot is Yuma at a mere 70 feet above sea level. All right, that is Clay Thompson's article titled, There's No Doubt About These Names and Elevations. And that was from the best of Clay Thompson from August 15th, 2015. Next up, we go to today's horoscopes, and today is Monday, April 6th. We start with Aries, which goes from March 21st to April 19th. Dare to dream bigger. A mental block dissolves. Reimagine your vision. Taurus, April 20th, May 20th. Dig deeper. People are reacting to you in interesting ways. Ask why. Gemini, May 21st, June 21st. Saying the quiet part out loud, the truth comes out in conversation with your partner as the moon and Pluto harmonize. Cancer, June 22nd, July 22nd. Cutting cords, eliminate a bad habit. Hint, it may look like a good habit. Leo, July 23rd, August 22nd. Feeling impish? Press your partner's buttons in a playful way as the moon and Pluto harmonize. Virgo, August 23rd, September 22nd. Transforming your surroundings, clear out the clutter, emotional and material, as the moon harmonizes with Pluto. Libra, September 23rd, October 23rd. Magnetically drawn into another's orbit, you'll meet somebody who touches your heart. Scorpio, October 24th, November 21st. Taking back what's yours, as the moon harmonizes with Pluto, reclaim your energy, time, or belongings. Sagittarius, November 22nd, December 21st. Highly sensitive, the moon and Pluto are harmonizing, stirring up emotions while delivering breakthroughs. Capricorn, December 22nd, January 19th. Facing your fears, the moon's connection to Pluto makes this a quietly empowering day. You need not to feel it to heal it. Aquarius, January 20th, February 18th. Craving depth connections, meaningful companionships, and their inevitable complexities are highlighted as the moon harmonizes with Pluto. And we have finally Pisces, February 19th to March 20th. Discovering your hidden motivations, use your latent magic to shift your public persona as the moon and Pluto harmonize. All right, that's the horoscopes for today. Next up, we go to Dear Abby. Her article today titled, Friends Are Unaware of My Silent Suffering. Dear Abby, I have a neurological disorder and can no longer keep up with my friends, who used to be my friends. I don't explain the problems I have and why I can't do the things I used to do unless they ask. I still drive, but I have trouble walking. I have a wonderful husband who helps me all the time. I'm lucky I can do what I do, but I am very limited. I don't know how to explain it to people who look at me like I'm making it up. Abby, I have polyneuropathy and have had 7 back surgeries. I have arthritis in all my joints. I live in constant pain, but it doesn't look like I do. How do I explain my disability? I'm tired of being at home and not getting phone calls anymore. How do I tell them there are still things I can do? This is from Down But Not Out in Rhode Island. Dear Down, by not discussing your problem, you have contributed to the isolation you are feeling. Not every disability is obvious. Your friends may think you are avoiding them because you don't want to be with them. You don't have to make any grand announcements, but you should have a frank talk with your closest friends about what your challenges are. Real friends will make an effort to accommodate you if you let them know you need them in your life. Once you start talking, the word will get around. Dear Abby, my niece married her second husband 2 months ago. In lieu of gifts, they asked for money to be used toward a future house. Instead of adding to the money tree, I handed her my envelope with cash and a card so she could put it away before the ceremony. I have not received any acknowledgement for the gift. Our family was together recently to celebrate a birthday, and she still didn't mention the gift. I could overlook the lack of a thank you note with a verbal acknowledgement, a text, or any sort of communication that she appreciated the gift. Should I mention this to her dad, my brother, or another aunt with whom she is close? She has also invited all the members of this side of the family to her home in another city, but has yet to invite my husband and me. I am really, really disappointed in her actions or lack thereof. Am I being too sensitive? This is from Discontented Aunt in Texas. Dear Aunt, you are not being too sensitive. Your niece's lack of manners is hurtful and disappointing. If she couldn't make the time to write you a note, she should have remembered to thank you for the gift when she saw you at the birthday celebration. The fact that you and your husband have been excluded from her family gathering makes me wonder what else may be going on with her. Rather than tattle to her father, I don't think you would be out of line to discuss it discreetly with the aunt you feel she's close to and ask for some insight. All right, that's Dear Abby's article today. It was titled, Friends Are Unaware of My Silent Suffering. All right, next up, we'll get to a few comics, and we will start with Beetle Bailey from Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. And we got a picture of Beetle, and Beetle is saying, the laundry shrunk my shirt. And in the next panel, we can see Beetle holding his arms out and looking at Sarge, and you can see his belly button showing above his belt. And Beetle continues, it's not my fault, it's untucked. All right, Beetle Bailey, Greg Bryan, and Neil Walker. Next up, we go see what the characters in Pickles are up to. And Pickles, again, is by Brian Crane. And we got the young man on the floor. Looks like he's got some crayons and his coloring book on the floor. And his grandma comes over and she says, did you brush your teeth this morning, Nelson? And Nelson looks up and says, oops, I forgot. And then grandma continues, and what about flossing? Have you been flossing your teeth? And then he goes back to his coloring and he says, yeah, I floss them all the time, once in a while. All right, that's Pickles by Brian Crane. Next up we go to The Baby Blues by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott. And Hammy's on the couch. Looks like he's got some type of electronic device in his hands and is making all kinds of sounds like beep, beep, boop, beep. And then his mother walks up to him and says to Hammy, come with me, Hammy. It's time you learned how to help with the laundry. And then Hammy stops with his electronic device, looks up and says, what's in it for me? And his mom looks down at him and says, clean underwear. And Hammy goes back to his electronic device and he goes, overrated. And then she yells, on your feet. All right, that's The Baby Blues by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott. Next up, we'll go to Blondie by Dean Young and John Marshall. And we have a bunch of co-workers of Dagwood's watching the TV, looking at the TV, and the TV is saying, experts now say that napping and snacking can increase productivity. And then Dagwood goes, I've been telling the boss that for years. And then the co-workers continue, you got to admire Dag. He not only walks the walk, and the next thing you know, he's got his feet up on his desk and he's falling asleep. He snacks the snack and naps the nap. All right, Blondie by Dean Young and John Marshall. All right, that's going to bring us to the close of today's reading of the Arizona Republic for Monday, April 6th. I'm volunteer reader Philip Vrellin. Thanks for joining us, and remember to stay tuned for further great programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.